With all the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies.
About 7:15, the telephone rang. It was the duty officer in the war room. Mr. Secretary, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. He wishes to speak to the president. So the president came on the line. He said, in effect, "Goddamn it, Bob, what are you calling me for at this time in the morning?" I said, "Mr. President, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. How do you wish to respond?"
Johnson didn't want the situation to turn into a military confrontation with the USSR. He immediately sent word to Moscow that with the help of the USSR and the UN, the U.S. will use any means to put an end to the war. The telecommunications officers of the ship were trying their best to transmit news of the attack to the 6th Fleet and ask them for help. But the noise that the attack jets were sending on the Liberty's frequencies to transmit communications prevented the transfer of the messages.
Here's a question I have to ask. Who would know the frequencies other than an ally? And who was the ally in the war? It wasn't Egypt. It was Israel.
In the end, one of the Liberty's transmissions reached the USS America warship, and the commander of the ship issued orders for two U.S. fighter jets to take off to defend the Liberty.
First identification was Soviet. I said, "Oh, my God." Come closer. I came closer and he identified her as an American ship.
Aside from that, the 5x8-foot American flag, which was flying high above the tallest pole of the ship, didn't leave room for the denial of the American identity of the ship. When the flag of the ship fell due to Israeli rocket attacks, under orders from the ship's commander, Captain McGonagall, another flag, a bigger one, was raised on the ship. Even if the Israelis denied all these, they couldn't claim that they weren't aware that all ships and warships of the U.S. Navy are gray. The next speculation regarding the attack on the Liberty came when, under pressure from the USSR, U.S. forced Israel to accept a U.N. ceasefire resolution. But Eshkol wanted to attach the Golan Heights to the soil of his country before formally accepting the resolution. And this caused speculations that Israel got rid of the Liberty so it could not inform the U.S. of its advances in the Golan Heights. Of course, the only way the U.S. could have found out about Israel's advance in Syria wasn't only from the Liberty. Aside from that, even if the Liberty were to send word of Israel's mischievous activities to the U.S., Israel's reaction shouldn't have been so harsh. To try and sink the ship of its friend and ally with all its members on board, something that could have provoked a military reaction from the U.S. Twenty days after the incident, the committee tasked with investigating the attack on the Liberty prepared a 600-page report and delivered it to the offices of the U.S. Naval Force in Europe. The report did not include that a napalm bomb was used during the attack, and most of the witness testimonies had been left out.
I testified, like I said, for about 2.5, 3 hours. I didn't know until, I don't remember, months later, that much of my testimony was never recorded.
After reviewing the report, Rear Admiral Merlin Starling, the U.S. Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy, said,
"As you know, it's a voluminous document. And one of the things that I initially had difficulty with, and still do, is the fact that the very first statement of fact that the court arrived at and presented was this: available evidence combines to indicate the attack on liberty on 8 June was in fact a case of mistaken identity." Now, that is the sort of thing in this record that I found great difficulty in supporting from the evidence that was included.
But the attack was neither a mistake nor an attempt to plug the ears of the U.S. The attack on the Liberty was part of a secret and complicated operation that the CIA and Mossad had planned in total intelligence silence. Communism was spreading exponentially in the Middle East, and the U.S. and Israel had to stop it and also prevent the Arabs in the region from becoming more powerful with the help of the USSR. The Soviets were using cables on the bed of the sea to transfer secret intelligence to the Egyptians. And for the U.S. to know what was going on between the USSR and Egypt, it had to listen in on the intelligence that was being transmitted back and forth. It might have also been doing damage to the cables so that it could cut off the underwater transfer of intelligence between the USSR and Egypt. This is how one of the most complicated covert operations during the Cold War was planned by the U.S. and Israel, the covert operation called Cyanide.
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it?
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
Is it very sensitive?
I am built so, and I know exactly what I am able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
2 months before the Six-Day War between the Arabs and Israel, on April 23rd, 1967, three American submarines were tasked with infiltrating Egypt's northern waters in the Mediterranean Sea and find out how the underwater intelligence was being transferred. The USS Truta, USS Amberjack, and USS Requin slowly and silently went toward the Mediterranean to see what was going on down there between the USSR and Egypt in the silence of the waters.
Operation Cyanide was a joint Israeli-American venture using submarines and other covert-type intelligence gathering efforts against the UAR. But that has a logical explanation. The explanation is the UAR was totally Soviet equipped. They had Soviet advisors. So the Soviet Union was our arch enemy at the time. And we're concerned in a volatile Mideast situation with the Soviet problem. We were concerned wherever the Soviets showed up. And they had considerable influence in the United Arab Republic. So there were these joint ventures with Israeli intelligence.
Even though the real battle between the two superpowers was going on underwater in the Mediterranean without the use of weapons, they were actually at war. One wanted to help Egypt and Syria get the upper hand in the Middle East and destroy Israel, and the other was fighting for the victory of Israel and the elimination of Soviet communism in the Middle East. Still, direct military confrontation between the two powerhouses wasn't unexpected at all either. Both the Soviet Union and the United States were looking for an excuse with all their might light the flames of World War III. Because the Middle East was the heart of the world's politics and energy supply, rivalry for superiority in the region was worth any kind of hardship. Operation Cyanide was designed in such a way that after the presence of submarines in Egypt's northern waters, the Liberty would get close to the region as a deceptive operation. This would allow Israel to attack it with its uncolored, unidentified fighter jets and bomb it in such a way that nothing would be left of the ship or its crew. But Israel's unsuccessful attack didn't cause the destruction of the ship. Also, the survival of witnesses, meaning wounded naval officers of the Liberty, Operation Cyanide, was a total failure. If Liberty had successfully sunk, then the U.S. could have easily accused Egypt for the attack. Then it could attack Egypt and push Nasser out of power and chop down the sapling of communism in the Middle East. But when Israel failed in sinking the ship, McNamara was forced to recall the planes, which had been equipped with nuclear bombs and were en route to Cairo. If nuclear weapons were used against Cairo, the USSR would undoubtedly declare war against the U.S., and a world war would begin so that the horrendous battle of the nuclear powers could decide the fate of the world. The U.S. and USSR were seemingly trying to establish a ceasefire and put an end to the Six-Day War, but in secret, on the battlefield, they were lined up against each other. The USSR had armed Egypt and Syria to the teeth and was helping them with intelligence, and aside from helping arm Israel, the U.S. did something else, too. Israel, which didn't even have a reconnaissance plane, was able to carry out an extremely meticulous identification operation and destroy the naval forces of its three Arab enemies. The extraordinary intelligence help, which turned the tables in favor of Israel, was also part of Operation Cyanide.
There was a hurry-up paint job done to the aircraft to identify them as Israeli aircraft so that they would be in conformance with normal Israeli markings. Take a look at the reconnaissance information that Israelis have. It was published publicly in Time magazine, Life magazine, I think Book magazine. That was our work. The Israelis had no reconnaissance aircraft, and you can't get the detail off of gun cameras that was in those films.
Abdel Nasser knew full well that Israel did not take part in the war without American support. But as he was talking about the same issue with the King of Jordan, he was not aware that the Mossad was listening in on their conversation.
I called up and said, "What is this? There aren't any American aircraft within 300 miles of Egypt." He said, "For your information, they could not possibly have done what they did without help. And that help had to come from you or the British. And we think it was you."
The Six-Day War was over, and Operation Cyanide hadn't achieved all of its goals. The Liberty's wounded crew returned to the U.S. so their country's officials could honor them for surviving the deadly cyanide operation by chance. The ceremony to award medals always takes place in the White House and by the U.S. President. But Captain McGonagall received his Medal of Honor in an open air in the Naval Sea Systems Command headquarters in Washington, D.C., without media presence from the Defense Secretary, because at the same moment, Johnson was busy handing out diplomas to students in the White House. He had in advance written in McGonagall's award ceremony guidance that due to the sensitive nature of the event, there should be no press coverage of the service.
When I received my Purple Heart in a secret ceremony in the captain's office, I was admonished, threat of court-martial, "Don't ever tell anyone where you got this. Don't ever tell anyone how you got this medal."
Years later, when the winter of 1998 arrived, Captain McGonagall wrote a letter to President Clinton and asked them to speak about the untold truths of the USS Liberty incident. Before that, a memorial ceremony held in Arlington Cemetery for those who had been killed in the incident, the captain had said that the time had come for the secrets of the Liberty to be revealed.
For many years, I had wanted to believe that the attack on the Liberty was pure error. It appears to me that it was not a pure case of mistaken identity. I think that it's about time that the State of Israel and the United States government provide the crew members of the Liberty and the rest of the American people the facts of what happened and why it came about that the Liberty was attacked 30 years ago today.
But the commander didn't have time to get his answer, and 3 months after writing his letter, he was put to rest in Arlington Cemetery next to the rest of the crew members of the Liberty. The days of the Cold War were passing by, and the cunning Eastern and Western superpowers were battling each other in secret and also openly, making peace, threatening each other, and using 1,001 plots and deceits to perhaps be able to eliminate their tenacious rival. And in the end, it was as if there was no competition or hostility between them. They would sit across from each other and smile diplomatically. Those paying the price for these smiles, conflicts, and complicated games were being paid by innocent people who perhaps had no interest in the games of the powerful or a share of their wins or losses. Their only share from these games was the lives they gave without the right to choose or ask questions, so evil forces could set foot on the days left of their lives and climb the ladder of power higher and ever so higher.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question which is kind of controversial, and it's related to something famous which has been narrated and in some of the books of Hadith. And also, it's common and well-known amongst people. A lot of times, it's recited on the pulpit as one of the virtues and fazail of Imam Ali alayhi salam. The question is this, that there's an event which has been narrated in some books of Hadith regarding the fact that one of the prayers of Imam Ali alayhi salam was he missed one of his prayers and he didn't perform one of his prayers, and this is something that has been mentioned in some of the books of Hadith. So this is a question we want to address today. In order to respond to this question, we can say, first of all, we need to say this, that based upon the narrations which have been mentioned, the prayer of Imam Ali alayhi salam, it didn't become elapsed, but and he didn't miss his prayer. Nevertheless, Sheikh Mufid, one of the famous scholars of Islam and Tashayyu, in his book Al-Irshad, which is a famous book regarding the life history of the 14 infallibles, he mentions an event which has been known and has been entitled as the event of the turning back of the sun. Sheikh Mufid says that this event has occurred two times, once in the life of the Holy Prophet and another after the death of the Holy Prophet. In the first narration, it has been mentioned it has been narrated from Asma, Umm Salma, Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari, Abu Sa'id al-Khizri, and other companions of the Prophet. They say that one day the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was in his house, and the Imam Ali alayhi salam was also present there at that time. Suddenly the angel Gabriel came down for the bringing of revelation from God. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam put his head upon the leg of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he didn't pick it up until the sun set. Imam Ali hadn't prayed his Asr prayers, his afternoon prayers, and when the Prophet picked up his head from the foot of Imam Ali, from the leg of Imam Ali, and the Imam Ali alayhi salam, he couldn't, there was not enough time left for him to pray in a normal manner. So therefore, Imam Ali alayhi salam prayed while sitting and with indications. As you know, in Islamic jurisprudence, it has been mentioned that if the time for prayer is short, one can pray through indications and can cut some of the non-necessary elements of the prayer, right? So, and this is what Imam Ali did in this time. So according to this tradition, right, narrated in Al-Irshad, which is a very authentic book, the Imam, he didn't miss his prayers, and his prayers were not elapsed. Nevertheless, it was performed by the Imam within the time allotted for the prayers, but in an unnatural manner. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he came out of that state in which revelation was being given to him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the event of the turning back of the sun, and if it indicates whether the imam's prayer elapsed and was missed by him or not. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. Dumped at sea, lost on land, or left to rot in shops and fridges, the global catch of fish is being wasted like never before, hurting not only the oceans but the nutrition of billions of people. But can it be reversed? We present you an article written by Emma Bryce. The piece is titled Millions of Tons of Dead Animals, The Growing Scandal of Fish Waste. In February of 2022, a Dutch-owned fishing trawler released a silvery stream of 100,000 dead fish, which carpeted several thousand square meters of ocean off the coast of France. The vessel's owners blamed the discharge on a faulty net. Environmental groups charged that the fish were intentionally dumped. Whatever the truth, that spectacle of squandered sea life was the tip of the iceberg. Figures from the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, show that in 2019, at least 230,000 tons of fish were dumped in European Union waters. Most of the waste, or 92% of it, is related to bottom trawling, a fishing method that scrapes the sea floor, indiscriminately scooping up everything in its path. But this figure is a small fraction of an even larger global issue. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, estimates that 35% of all fish, crustaceans and mollusks harvested from oceans, lakes and fish farms are wasted or lost before they ever reach a plate. Fish are highly perishable and fragile, which makes them more vulnerable to waste, a problem that is compounded by hemorrhaging fish at every step of the supply chain. Pete Pearson, Senior Director for Food Waste at the World Wildlife Fund, says, "Fish waste is especially shocking because they are wild animals, so we are harvesting wildlife. Fish populations are already threatened by overfishing, pollution, and the climate crisis. With current rates of fish consumption projected to double by 2050, waste is increasingly on the radar of regulators." Omar Peñaruba, a fishery officer at the Food and Agricultural Organization, says, We have to do something about it. Experts say that begins with understanding exactly what is driving waste between harvest and plate. The task is made difficult by fisheries' notoriously opaque supply chains and incomplete data sets that are also inconsistent, although the evidence is clear that most fish waste starts at the point of extraction. Just under half of all fish consumed by people is wild, caught at sea. Pete Pearson says, "There's such an abundance that we've grown to be okay with certain loss rates, although noting that 34% of global marine stocks are now overfished. Bycatch, unintentionally caught unwanted fish, is a growing problem. Roughly 10% of wild caught fish are discarded worldwide each year, representing 8.6 million tons of animals. The main culprits are imprecise fishing gear and policies that allow fishers to discard non-target species. There's an economic driver too. Rashid Sumaila, Professor of Ocean and Fisheries Economics at the University of British Columbia in Canada, says, "I think there is a strong connection between subsidies and waste in the water. Although subsidies were historically devised to support small-scale fishers, Professor Sumaila's research shows today 80% of $35.4 billion in annual fishing subsidies goes to a handful of industrial fleets. These include gargantuan bottom trawlers that are uniquely equipped to travel out to the high seas and overfish, leading to discards on an industrial scale. Professor Somela says the impact of illegal and unreported fishing is also important, as it is likely contributing tons more bycatch to global fish waste. Fish waste is about more than just the physical loss of fish. For the 3 billion people whose diets depend on fish, it is a lost nutritional opportunity. Shakuntala Tilstead, global lead for nutrition and public health at World Fish and winner of the 2021 World Food Prize, says, "The narrative is that we have to produce more to feed the growing masses, but the greatest pathway to increasing supply is reducing loss and waste." Many sea-controlled aquaculture systems or fish farms, which generate more than half of our fish supply, as a solution to the waste of wild fishing. But Dave Love, senior scientist at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, says that various factors such as disease are driving considerable losses on fish farms too. Dave Love says mortality in fish ponds is actually a significant source of lost potential food. Fish waste continues after harvest, though how it unfolds differs depending on location. Omar Pinarubia says the Food and Agricultural Organization estimates that 27% of all fish globally is lost or wasted after landing, but in low-income countries, the fish is more likely to be unintentionally lost than wasted. One study showed that in Ghana, in Burkina Faso and Togo, 65% of lost fish on land was attributable to poor handling, lack of storage facilities and cooling facilities on fishing vessels, and along the lengthy supply chain. Fish disappear after distribution too, but here the culprits are retailers and consumers, almost exclusively in middle and high-income countries. In North America, Oceania and Europe, fish waste at consumption far outstrips that of any other region in the world. Pete Pearson thinks retailers in the United States partly contribute to the problem by prioritizing large fresh fish to sell at a premium, which quickly spoil. He says, "This is the real tragedy because it's moved all the way through the supply chain, and then we're comfortable with a 10% to 30% loss rate in the grocery store." Dave Love published a research showing that retailers were responsible for about 16% of wasted seafood in the United States, while up to 63% comes down to consumers putting uneaten fish in the bin. He says when retailers prioritize fresh fish, the ripple effect is that consumers are more likely to waste that in their homes. Solutions do exist to reduce fish spoilage along the supply chain. Increasing access to cold chain technologies in low-income countries, along with methods such as solar-powered drying tents, could extend the shelf life of fish. Omar Pinarubia says fishers and processors also need training on better fish handling and storage to limit loss. Pete Pearson and Dave Love argue that at the consumer end, we should encourage more people to opt for frozen fish, which could reduce demand for fresh fish in grocery stores and limit the amount that is lost in retail and people's homes. Tilstead suggests diversifying our appetites beyond the ubiquitous fish fillet to smaller fish and bivalves, which can be consumed whole to reduce waste. She says, "If our notion of fish is a fillet on a pan, then we are already far down the path of loss and waste because we have reduced the edible part to such a small portion of the whole. Existing fish byproducts can be captured and turned into new ones. Fish heads, fish fins and bones from the fishing industry are already a source of fertilizer and feed. Now innovators are finding uses for everything from fish skin for burn treatments and crustacean waste to make biodegradable packaging. However, Pete Pearson, who cautions that we shouldn't overstate these solutions, says, "The idea of full utilization is something that needs to be pervasive across all food supply chains. Unless fish byproducts replace a share of fish demand, they are simply making use of waste, not reducing it at source." Ultimately, Pete Pearson says, prevention is the best solution, starting at sea, where this problem begins. Fishers need to be equipped with more selective gear for fishing and aided by policies that discourage discards. Professor Samela underscores the need for good subsidies that can be channeled towards fisheries that help replenish wild stocks. He says, "We need to spend taxpayer money in ways that reinforce positive feedback from people to nature and from nature to people." Pete Pearson says, "For generations we've believed the ocean is huge and we can just take whatever we want from the ocean. Now we're coming to see the limits of that, and when you have limits, it requires you to become more efficient."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the solutions of your problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Well, today to provide you with those very beautiful tips based on Quran and narrations, we have with us in the studio our guest speaker, who is a world-famous speaker and Islamic researcher. Yes, she is none other, Razia Batul Najafi. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me here in this beautiful discussion.
Thank you so much for coming, despite your busy schedule. Well, sister, we have been talking on different phases of Islamic upbringing. We talk about bedtime upbringing. And in bedtime upbringing, as you beautifully mentioned in our previous sessions, that we could recite ahadiths in different, you know, tones, in different forms. We can form our own lyrics. We can just do wonders if we want. And that way we are providing education to our children, the Islamic education. Plus, we are giving them time, which is very, very important. Because in this today's life, parents don't have enough time for their children. However, today I would want to ask you, when these children are growing up in the cultures who have these headsets or, music in their ears all the time. And you said in the previous sessions that we have bedtime, a beautiful time wherein you can recite these ahadith. Which is the beautiful age of a children? Which is the best age when a mother can start this process?
Well, the way we have talked before too, that the training of children doesn't start after his birth. Even during the pregnancy, if a mother and even the father, you know, before pregnancy, they say, you know, the food which father eats, it gives so much very, very deep impact on maybe the color of the child, you know, the personality of the child. So the way father is thinking also very important. But after pregnancy, definitely the most, the very vital role mother is playing.
By a mother, okay.
So if mother is reciting Quran, can you believe it? What will happen? The child, Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, the way he's just building that child's like eyes and, you know, all the limbs, the same way you are providing the spiritual food towards your child and your child's flesh, blood, yeah, skin, yeah, we say goshto, posto, istakhano, bones, and everything is just mingle, you know, totally mingle with the beautiful divine messages of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, and we would see hereafter, you know, how much
the
this
results.
Quran, yeah,
right,
you know, can just bring that amazing change. You know, you can change the DNA by beautiful recitation of your Quran, and you can change whole cells and, you know, whole wujud by this amazing wordings of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. So I usually say the ayat of Noor, yeah, the verse of Noor, Allahu Nuru Samawati wal Ard masalu nurihi kamishkat, that ayah, I love it, and it has recommended that, you know, a pregnant woman, if she recites that ayah, because this ayah has love of 14 ma'asumeen alayhimus salam and Allah. Allah is the noor, and the reflection of that noor you can see in these 14 infallibles very beautifully. So the perfect noor package you can get by this ayah too. So at least if you don't have time as a pregnant mother to open up the book of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, you can just recite Surah Tawheed, Surah Qasr, and Ayatul Noor as many as times you can. Yeah.
All right. So as a pregnant woman, if you're not doing very well, you are like, because a woman mostly has nausea and all that thing, she can simply recite whatever she has.
Yeah.
Whatever she remembers. Yeah. All right, sister, I'll be talking to you, but after a very short break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about Islamic upbringing, and the sister touched a point. It does not start at the very moment the child is born, but very before that. Even it depends on the food the father eats. One can never imagine that this can have impact on the upbringing of a child. So a halal food and the way a father eats, it's all important in that, you know, embryo making thing. Well, sister, you said that the time does not start after the birth of a child. So a pregnant woman can just simply recite the verses she remembers by heart. Well, that was one part of the story, sister. Now I would want to ask you a very different question. Once the children are like, they grow up, they become rebellious, they become, you know, they start becoming furious, they start doing this and that, and even parents become furious at them and they start simply slapping them or, like, you know, behaving very terribly. our parents allowed to behave that way?
We all know that parenting is not an easy job. But the main thing is that what kind of intention you have. If my intention is pure, yeah, if I'm not taking revenge, if I'm not in a very hyper mood, I know my child is wrong. Yeah, I really want to teach her or him the manners. So I have to pause. That time, no, that is not a time, yeah, to directly attack on my child. For example, if my child is very, very hyper and he is just, you know, mischieving with me, so if I just reply in the same way, I'm just thinking, maybe I'm advising, you know, I'm saying, no, this is not a right way. How come you're, you know, talking in this tune with your mom and whatever? So that is not a right way.
That's not Islamic.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
Exactly. If my intention is pure, if I'm saying, okay, I really want to fix my child. Look at his manner. Look at his temper. Oh. He's not my type. He or she doesn't look my child. So now I'm worried, no doubt. But for my that worries, I need some time. So I should just, you know, push the pause button. And I have to reflect. And then maybe I can have
where
a glass of water. Yeah. And then I should mention the problem, no doubt. But it depends how to put it. You know, sometimes I talk in a very insulting way.
All right.
Sometimes I'm just mentioning the problem. I say, yes, my Hussein, this is not a right way to talk to your mom. I know you want a chocolate, for example. I know you don't want to wear this socks. I know. But what do you think? Do you have any other way to talk to your mom? You know, you put some questions, just question them and ask them for solutions, you know.
All right.
And you can't believe it, Sister Zainab. I'm always thinking about this story of Imam Ali alayhi salam, very famous story that Amr bin Abdawad, an enemy guy, when he started to insult Imam Ali and he was throwing his, you know, saliva towards Imam. Imam didn't attack on him. He wanted to kill him, but he said, no, if I kill him, yeah, attack him, that would be my nafs.
Personal.
Yeah, my personal.
This became personal.
So most of the time we, in parenting, we go to the personal issues, you know. We say, I'm tired. How come, you know, he or she is not appreciating my efforts? Me, you know?
Yeah.
So that is shaitani. So we have to be very careful. It looks so holy, very, you know, sacred, but it's not. It's not. So I think this is the area where we have to reflect a lot and gain so much sawab and reward by parenting and by training our children. But the only way is to have that pure intention, inshallah.
Inshallah. We'll talk on that, but after a very short break. We'll be back. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said The best among you is he who learns the Quran and teaches it.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. Sister, you know, I recently got a very, fancy kind of bedding for my children. And once I was showing it to my very close friend, my friend was like, wow, nice. What a nice mother you are. I said, yes, I did so many efforts. I hope my children remember this tomorrow. And there was a striking point coming in from the side of my friend. And that was, don't do things for the fact that they remember. Do things for Allah. You know, don't do, because most of the parents, as parents, we don't even realize. But we do so many things for our children just to have this notion, I hope she remembers tomorrow what his mother did for him. I hope this boy of mine remembers tomorrow how many efforts his father did. So is that an Islamic wish? Shall we be expecting from our children?
So yeah, you are right. Here we are lacking, unfortunately, because our intention, you know, when we are performing ibadat, like salah, like namaz, like prayers, we say qurbatan ilallah, but we are thinking this is not an ibadat, yeah? This is not an ibadat. That is our biggest mistake. And, you know, therefore, unfortunately, we say the purest, the most loving, caring relationship is between parents and child. But still, this relationship is not that pure, you know. Still, we are so selfish. You know, we want more boys sometimes. Why? Because they can take care of us financially in future, you know, yeah. Sometimes in some countries. So we are just thinking about this dunya, benefits of this dunya, this world, not hereafter. So if you don't have any expectation, fully you are relying on Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, that your intention definitely will impact on this beautiful parenting. You know, that parenting will become very nurani, you know, very holy, full of ilahi and divine fragrance. Yeah. Yeah. So and then you will get the amazing, powerful result.
Yeah.
Because you will get that respect from bottom of their heart, inshallah.
Yes. Inshallah. So the basic thing is that we don't need to be expecting more. Even if we are expecting, we need to expect from Allah. That was really a wake-up call for me. Because I really did not have that, you know, senses that what I am expecting. I'm expecting from a children. Oh, my expectation is so small. I should be expecting from Allah. I should be expecting more. Thank you so much, sister.
You're most welcome.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much to your listeners who are listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Until another session, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.